Hello, everyone, and welcome to another in ISHN series, Dave Johnson's Wide World of Safety. I'm Dave Johnson, your host, and ISHN Editor-at-Large, which is a fancy title after spending 40 years as the magazine's chief editor. Now, today, I'm very pleased to welcome Ed Folk to our podcast. Ed is the only attorney confirmed by the U.S. Senate to run the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Ed served as head of OSHA from April 2006 to November 2008 in the George W. Bush administration. He also chaired the OSHA Review Commission from 1990 to 1994. Ed is currently a partner in the law firm Fisher Phillips. He is the former co-chair of the firm's Workplace Safety and Catastrophe Management Practice Group, and he's also the president of Fisher Phillips Safety Solutions, LLC, which offers site safety audits, training and education, and safety policies and procedures. Ed, thanks a lot for joining us here today.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it.
The first question I have for you is probably the most obvious one, Ed. What do you see happening with the now pretty long delayed OSHA Federal Emergency Temporary Standard for COVID, which, as you know, was, according to President Biden, a go-no-go decision on the ETS was supposed to come down over a month ago, back in the middle of March. Still haven't seen anything. What do you hear or what's your expectation of what's going to happen with that ETS?
Yeah. Well, I think what you're seeing, when they came out with the National Emphasis Program for COVID was about on March 12th, right before the 15th, right, when they were supposed to come out with the emergency temporary standard. When I saw that, I thought, okay, they're not going to do a emergency temporary service standard. They're going to just use this National Emphasis Program on COVID to cover the areas that they really kind of want to cover. I mean, if you look at the Appendix A, the main primary list, it pretty much covers those industries that they wanted to cover: healthcare, nursing homes, poultry. They are going to do it. They're just trying to work it through. And then, okay, so I thought, okay, well, they got a new Secretary of Labor, so he wants to have his input into it, which they all, you know, all sure, on something that important. I think that the Secretary is going to want to have to put his eyes on it and see what it's as. And so, and then things just kind of drug on here. And now, I'm not exactly sure. I thought they were going to go move with it, but my thought is, you know, the more vaccinations we have.
Yeah.
And if they're able to turn the corner and all the states start showing all decreases in the COVID cases instead of having to spike up, you know, it kind of defeats the purpose of having an emergency temporary standard, because there won't be really much of an emergency.
Right.
And I think, and that's kind of what's in the back of their minds. You know, I've been trying to use this as a basis for getting my clients to be really focused on their COVID response, continue to stay focused on it, make sure they're doing they have the action plan in place. They're doing the social distancing, they're doing the masks, they're doing the sanitation, they're doing the health screening, all those things, because what I'm concerned about, and I think this may be the bigger story come down the road, is that you're going to see, I think, in the next 2 years, a significant number of tort lawsuits being filed by the plaintiff bar against employers based on covert issues. Basically, employees who had COVID-19 particularly if they were hospitalized and had a really bad time with it. Or if they had those employees who had COVID. Now, I'm not saying they necessarily got it at the office.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. How do you determine work relatedness, Ed?
Yeah. Well, that was the kind of the thing that puzzled and was a little bit difficult for OSHA to get his hands around at the beginning, particularly. But what I'm concerned about too is if they have a fatality, I think you're going to see a lot of tort lawsuits based on wrongful death actions in the next 2 years, because most states, the statute of limitations is 2 or 3 years. So I think employers need to realize if they have had somebody who has had who had COVID-19, who was hospitalized, or employees who were had COVID-19 and died, they weren't tracked as being work related. You got some potential serious legal liabilities facing you.
Yeah, you got some exposure there.
Yeah, you got to recognize that. You need to recognize this and be able to make sure that you have the documentation to show you got some potential liability. When the pandemic first started up, I was getting a lot of calls from clients, and they were saying, and like I say, OSHA, like you mentioned, OSHA kind of was having trouble too. They kind of trying to get their hands around work related, and there was always the presumption in the record keeping standard that if it had happened at work, it was work related.
Right.
So, but that kind of, they said, no, we're going to change that. It was kind of more relaxed thing for about four or five months. And then they moved it back and then put the onus on employers to show that it wasn't work related, that the employers had to make that determination. But I remember having clients tell me, oh, they were excited because, well, I got employees that got in COVID-19, but my workers' comp says that it's not work related. And therefore, I'm sitting there going, well, let's look at this a little bit, really. If you're claiming, if in fact it's not work related, that's one thing, but you're going to have to make sure you've got a strong case to show this. The insurance carriers or the workers' comp carriers are saying it's not work related, and this is great because we don't have to, it's not going to impact our mod rate. I'm going, yeah, but what happens if you say it's not work related and then some civil lawsuits filed against you and claiming that it is work related and now you don't have that workers' comp protection?
I was going to say, the workers' comp shield doesn't shield against civil lawsuits, right?
Well, no, it would be a bar. I mean, but the problem is if you're claiming that it's not work related and they file a lawsuit, a tort lawsuit saying it was, and you haven't claimed workers' comp and you haven't paid out on workers' comp.
Right.
Now you're sitting looking at it, particularly on wrongful death. Well, even any type of civil action, you're looking at maybe multi-million dollar legal liability. So, I tried to tap down my client's enthusiasm for the fact that they said it wasn't work related and wasn't workers' comp. Because I said, you're not paying workers' comp, but maybe if they were getting workers' comp, now you got that bar, and now they can't sue you for a wrongful death action because you claim the bar.
Yeah. It seems like one of the important points you're making to your clients, Ed, is not only do you need the right protocols and the right plan and the right measures in place, but documentation is very important. You got to document.
It's just, you never get around it. If you don't have the documentation, even with respect to OSHA comes in and says, show me the training records. And I said, we don't keep those things. We do the training, but we don't take records. Well, guess what? If you can't document it, it never happened. And here it's even worse. I mean, the potential for legal liability is unfortunately fairly great. And so that's why I'm encouraging all my clients, make sure that you have your COVID action plan in place. Make sure you can document, you're doing the screening, you're doing the social distance, you're doing the mask. Because you look at all these things, look at all the lawsuits that have already been filed. There's a bunch been filed out in California and I think Oregon and Washington State and some other states too. But it's exactly the same. My employer wasn't enforcing the mask requirement. He wasn't enforcing social distancing. He wasn't doing medical screening, wasn't asking the questions, wasn't taking temperatures, wasn't doing sanitation. Those are all if you look at the lawsuits, the complaints have been filed, these are the things that they're focusing as a basis for the lawsuit. So we got to make sure we have all that in place and make sure we have whatever documents have. And also to make sure that our managers and supervisors are going to be able to articulate those things that we did, a year ago. Because you, like I say, some of these states, the statute of limitations, 2-3, maybe there may be some states even as high as 5 years. Well, who's going to remember what happened 3 years ago?
Right.
I can't hardly remember what happened last year.
Yeah.
So, But my wife will remind me of those things.
What advice are you giving clients, Ed, who are coming to you and saying, what should our policy be on vaccinations now? You know, there's the debate, they should be mandatory. No, they can't be mandatory. What are you telling your clients
when it comes to vaccinations? Basically, we'd been saying that we didn't think that we should be, we weren't encouraging our clients to require mandatory vaccination. And that became even more clear last week when OSHA came out with their new Q&As on COVID, where they're saying that if you are requiring a employees to get vaccinated and they have an adverse reaction, that goes on the 300 log.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't know that.
So, yeah, that came out end of last week. So that kind of verified what it is. And it's just the problem is the mandatory, you know, there are industries, particularly like healthcare,
right,
nursing homes, mm-hmm, retirement communities, those people do have to probably really should be vaccinated. I mean, for them, protection of themselves, but also for the protection of their patients.
Right.
But other than that, our advice has always been, we don't think you need to require it. Even under this new Q&A's interpretations, they're even saying if you kind of encourage employees to get it, and somehow they get in, and they don't, and they suffer consequences that could be considered retaliation. So, you know,
it's interesting.
You know, I think that's why you probably don't want to require it. You can encourage it,
yeah,
but if you're going to encourage it, then just because in some way doesn't do it, that's okay. No harm, no foul, because we're, you know, maybe we'd like to have them all happen.
Well, here's a question kind of related. I've read articles in the last year. In fact, I read an article where you gave some input on the idea that safety and health pros have, I don't want to call it an opportunity as a result of COVID-19, but they've... certainly their visibility in a lot of corporations is higher. They've gotten more responsibilities. They've been brought in on these emergency kind of crisis situations. And the thinking, at least in some circles, is that long-term, this could be something of a tipping point maybe. And maybe safety and health professionals now, certainly not 100%, but in a number of corporations, are going to have maybe more clout, more credibility, more visibility than they've had before. What are your thoughts on what the consequences of COVID could be for the profession longer term?
Well, I've actually said this I've done a lot of webinars. I used to do a lot of speeches, but now I do a lot of webinars. Although I did do a speech down in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago. There were 900 roofers there. So those people wanted to come out, get out. So they did a good job of social, even in the main ballroom. I mean, it was a huge ballroom though. They had people spread out pretty well. But anyway, I've been saying that all on my webinars, that if there's one thing positive that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic is the fact that the safety profession is now its visibility has been dramatically enhanced. Its usefulness or its you know, what they've done in protecting employees has been raised higher visibility. And you know, I've been always talked about getting the safety profession to the C-suite. I mean, I've done webinars just on that topic. It's always been kind of a tough road to hoe, to be honest with that. I went through the time period back when I was very active with Society of Human Resource Management, SHRM.
Yeah.
And you know, they took a very direct approach and said, we want to get the HR person into the C-suite, and they've been fairly successful because I mean there are a lot of VPs of HR. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of VPs of safety.
Right.
And I'm hoping that this kind of has opened up the door to the safety profession. I feel like I'm proud of what the safety profession has done with respect to the pandemic, handling the pandemic, being there. And I think they've been able to show that safety is an important aspect of continuing operations. So I am hopeful that this will continue, and we'll see more and more maybe VPs of safety in companies around the country. Basically recognizing the contributions that safety makes to the overall success, profitability, competitiveness. What do you
basically
mean?
Adding value to the
company.
The value added to the company. Yeah, I would say it to your point about the C-suite. Certainly, some safety professionals who had trouble getting into the C-suite before in the last year due to COVID found themselves sitting at the table. I think now the issue is, okay, once the pandemic calms down, can you show the value, and can you show the contributions to keep you in the C-suite?
And that's not easy. And unfortunately, and what I've been talking about on these, like I say, even in the webinars and the speeches I've done on, you know, getting the safety profession to the C-suite, you know, when the bottom line is, you got to know what, you know, you got to understand business. And maybe that's kind of where we've fallen a little bit behind there, understanding return on investment. Understanding how, when you're able to reduce costs, how that saves money for the company. But also, you got to be able to touch base to those C-suite people that are there, the CEO, the COO, CFO. You got to be able to touch their buttons.
Yeah.
And what are their buttons? Well, they want to know, well, if we do this, the return on investment is going to be this amount. We're going to save this amount. This is going to impact the company's profitability by X, which will probably impact the price per share, the pennies per share, because it is pennies. That could be dramatically, but they understand a penny per share. If you can save them and you can make them increase the value of the share by even a penny, that's an important thing because it impacts in the long term on their bonuses. And that's where it all ends up. You've got to be able to understand what you want to propose, what are the things you're going to do, how it's going to end, what's the return on investment, how it's going to impact on the profitability, competitiveness of the company, how it's going to hit the bottom line, how it's going to hit the stock price if you're a publicly traded private. And finally, and maybe as most importantly,
yes,
is how does it impact the CEOs or the CFOs or the COOs bonus.
Compensation, yeah. Let me bring you back to Washington and ask you another obvious question about Doug Parker, former OSHA, Cal OSHA chief, who issued the much debated, criticized in a number of quarters, emergency temporary standard in California. As you know, Doug's also an activist, having directed WorkSafe, a California worker advocacy nonprofit, for a couple of years. He's a former union member of United Auto, United Mine Workers. And he is in an administration, as you well know better than I, where he answers to a very pro-union labor secretary, who I think joined his union when he was 21 or something like that. And a president who says he wants to be the most pro-labor president that you've seen. So given these circumstances, and there's also a couple of aides in the OSHA front office, as you know, deputies or chief of staff that have union backgrounds as well. So my question is, given these circumstances, given the atmosphere, and given Doug Parker's experience, describe how you see Doug Parker steering the OSHA ship in the next 3 years?
Well, I think you pretty well laid it out clearly. I mean, this is going to be a very union dominated Department of Labor. I mean, but that's okay. You know, I always said before, and I'm saying it now, if you win the election, you get to choose the people and you get to choose the policies.
Yeah.
And so elections do matter. So we have that situation. So and so I can't complain. I mean, you know, I was in an administration that was a Republican administration that was, you know, I thought we were trying to do. I always try to do the right thing for employee safety. That's all I care. Mm-hmm. To me, the bottom line is employee safety. And I wasn't so worried about penalties, and I wasn't worried about a lot of big citations and a big press releases. I wanted to make sure that the employees were safe. And I think what you're going to, and I was, and obviously we were, I was more of a compliance assistance type focused on alliances, partnerships. I was a big VPP person. So I think what you have coming into play here, you got to give him credit though. I mean, look, I mean, Trump never got an assistant secretary.
Right.
And shame on the Republicans for not getting that done. So because nothing really moved there, even with an acting deputy, the acting deputies generally don't want to move. It's not their job technically. I mean, it is, but it isn't. You know, so they don't move. They don't move the things that they move some stuff. I mean, during the Trump administration, they did move some stuff, but you know, but you got to give credit. Trump's moving on a lot. Biden is moving on a lot of things. So I've been doing this a long time. I was in every presidential election from Nixon in 72 to Bush W, the second one. And I haven't seen an administration that has moved as quickly as this one has. And there's a lot of stuff. They've had a lot of pent up, you know, they haven't been able to control the Senate for a while. And they have all these things that they've been wanting to do for a long time, but they had just teed up and had voted on and got voted down in the past. And now it's ready to go. They're trying to get everything they want to do in the last 10 years done in the first 100 days of Biden. So I think you're going to see clearly because of the union emphasis at the Department of Labor, you're going to see it's going to be more of enforcement driven. It was enforcement driven during Obama, Clinton, I look back and say, okay, when I was assistant secretary for those 3 years, you know, our numbers were as good as Clinton's. So inspection numbers. Our inspection numbers are good or better than Clinton's. I think you'll see more of that. I think you're going to see more. They're going to be a push next year in the budgets to get more inspectors. There's a lot of slots that are still open. They have slots. It's not that they don't have slots that they can put more inspectors in. You know, and during the Obama administration, they were taking people out of compliance assistance and moving them over to enforcement. You had to do that through the budgetary process. It's not that you can say, okay, you're over here, you're in compliance. Now, tomorrow you're going to be over here in enforcement. You can't do that. You have to do it through the budgetary process. But there are plenty of slots that have already been through the budgetary process for enforcement that they'll start filling. And then they'll do this. And then you may see more compliance assistance, although to be quite frank, the number of compliance assistance people is fairly low. And so maybe they'll move some more over there, but I don't think you're going to see the focus being on VPP. I mean, but then again, even in Trump, the number of VPP sites went down. And so I think you just got to recognize that as it is. So I think it'll be more enforcement, go back to the harsh press releases, try to emphasize more, more citations, bigger penalties. I think that's the type of things that you're going to see here, because they're of a belief, the Dems have always been the belief, and they bring out these statistics and these studies that have been done that say that enforcement improves safety. Well, yeah, maybe at the beginning, but if you look at the numbers now, even during the Obama administration, which was enforcement there, some of their injury and illness and DART rate numbers and fatality numbers did kind of go up a little bit. So, you know, you got to just understand that. But I've never been a big believer that enforcement is the silver bullet that's going to get you to zero injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. And I don't believe it ever will. I think you have to have enforcement. There's no doubt about it. Focused enforcement, but you got to somehow drive employers to want to have a great safety program. So that's kind of.
Putting that aside, what would you say to listeners, safety and health pros, in 2001, looking at their own careers in the next couple of years? We've talked about what OSHA may be doing in the next couple of years. What are your thoughts? What would you tell, or what have you told safety and health professionals that they should be thinking about for their own career's sake, and furthering their own development and their own status in organizations? What should professionals be thinking?
Okay. I mean, there's a number of things you got to be doing. You can't stop learning. You know, you gotta be doing additional, looking what's out there on webinars or seminars and stuff like that, those type of things. What I would suggest to safety professionals out there, that you need to look at the consensus standards that are directly impact your industry. What are those ones? And they're constantly being updated. They're usually updated every 3 to 5 years. Well, you need to figure out, okay, which ones are impacted? What are they going to, and look out and try to find out what agency, what group is responsible for that? Who's the responsible agency? ASACE is some of them. AIHA is some of them.
Right.
ISO, different ones. But anyway, find out those standards that are really applicable to your operation and get on the darn committee. Yeah. Become the subject expert, matter expert on that, your particular standards that directly and dramatically impact your standard. And now you're making yourself more valuable, because you're now the person. You're one of the people that helped write the standard. You are the one that had revised the standard. You understand all these. You understand all the changes that were made. I mean, it is an amazing process that you go through here. These things, these standards, these writing standard things, when they're being worked on, and when the consensus standards are being updated, there's a lot of, there's meetings. There's not as many meetings as you would think, but there are meetings, and you need to go to those meetings, because now you got to say, okay, now I'm meeting other people who are also experts in this, my field, in things that impact me, who I can benchmark with, who I can talk to about, who I can get new ideas. And so I can take those new ideas and I can show the my CEO, my CFO, here's the things that we need to do. So you got to explain to them. You got to speak their language.
Yeah.
And that's why you may need to be taking a few business courses at your local community college or something like that, that will explain, be able to articulate that. And then you can start formulating, then, with your expertise that you got, and then start thinking outside the box, things that, what can I do here for my company? Where's the problems? Look at your OSHA 300 logs.
Right.
Find out where their problems are. What do we have, and what can I do? What programs can I help put in place? What can I come to my CEO and CFO and start talking about? These are the programs we need to implement.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much, Ed, for spending a lot of time with us today and sharing your experience, very informed insights in this podcast. If you'd like to learn more about the work that Ed and Ed does and Fisher Phillips Safety Solutions, what that's about, visit this website, www.fpsafetysolutions.com. That's all lowercase, strung together. And
yeah, they can contact me through my email, efoulke@fisherphillips.com, all one word.
And please join me, folks, for the next in the series of Dave Johnson's Wide World of Safety podcasts. It's all about keeping you informed and, as we've talked about today, adding value to your work and your career. Again, thanks for joining us.